This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Reflect with us today. It's 9 years and 364 days since two bombs exploded at the finish line of the Boston Marathon. Tomorrow, it's 10 years. And if it's not too hard for you to join us, and for some of you it might be, we'd like to reflect together, holding on to a spirit of service and hope, which is how that day started.
Napoli to left field. Does it have enough? Back goes Joyce looking up. That ball is off the wall. Pedroia racing around the bases is headed home.
On Patriots Day in 2013, Nesson covered the Red Sox's 3-2 walk-off win against the Tampa Bay Rays. Here at WBUR, we reported that Lalisa DeCisa won the Boston Marathon on the men's side and Rita Jupitu won the women's race. The 3 p.m. newscast had NPR's Dave Mattingly on economic headwinds in the construction sector. And then, a few minutes later,
Dow is down 184 points. This is NPR.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Good afternoon. I'm Steve Brown in Boston. There's word that there's been two large explosions at the finish line of the Boston Marathon. Several media reports saying people are being...
Over the next few hours, information poured in. And our reporters raced to gather, vet, and bring it to you, even as it shocked and stunned the world. Here is 16-year-old Genevieve Daugherty live on our air a little before 4:30 p.m.
There was blood everywhere. There were people hurt, like random like chips in their leg from buildings, blood everywhere, like apparently limbs lying around.
Minutes later, WBUR's Deborah Becker spoke with Boston Globe reporter David Abel.
There were people lying on the ground, mangled, blood, glass shattered. It was really chaos.
And this is from you who've covered war zones.
I've covered a lot of things, and this is probably the worst thing I've ever seen.
Retired WBUR reporter Bruce Gellerman stayed with first responders.
The police have cleared much of the area. They won't let anybody, including reporters, down to the finish line. You can hear the ambulances. You can hear the helicopter.
And WBUR health reporter Martha Biebinger tracked the medical response to the bombings.
We don't have an exact confirmation, but unfortunately, it looks like that death count is going to rise. It's kind of hard to fathom what's going on in hospital emergency rooms.
Ultimately, three people died in the bombings, over a dozen more lost limbs, and the feeling in the air on Marathon Monday changed forever. In part one of our reflections, Steve Brown and Martha Biebinger join us now to reflect on serving WBUR listeners that day as the events unfolded. Steve, you're here in Studio 2. Welcome.
Thank you, Tiziana.
And Martha Biebinger on the line. Martha, thanks for joining us. We may have lost Martha. I'm sure we'll get her back momentarily. Steve, you just walked down here from Studio 1, and I know that's where you were when it all unfolded that day. Tell us what was going through your head as the news started to come into you.
Yeah, it was difficult to kind of process it all. I mean, as news anchors and news reporters, sometimes we have to build that little wall between, you know, our feelings and the news that we're reporting. It's heavy stuff. And we had just found out a few minutes before that local newscast that something had gone on. There were explosions at the finish line. So, you know, we flipped on the TV and saw, you know, you just saw that static shot of the finish line, just, you know, mayhem there at the finish line. A lot of the people had been evacuated from there. Our producer at the time, Shannon Mullen, was working the phone trying to get some sort of confirmation. And so we kind of had to wing it there, that very beginning, basically describing what I was seeing on the TV screen that we had in our studio. We still have it. And the information that we could confirm, which was very, very spotty at that point in time. It's one of the few newscasts where at the end of the newscast, I said, repeating our top story. That's how big the story was. But, you know, you don't know at the time, was it terrorism? Was it, you know, some sort of a utility explosion? Sometimes that happens, manhole covers go. And so we didn't know the magnitude at the time.
You know, I remember yesterday on the show, we had celebrity chef Tiffany Faison, who's
restaurant Sweet Cheeks was open on Boylston Street. And the first thing when I asked her about it, she said to me, I don't know if you remember, but the previous year a generator had blown. And their first thought was that a generator blew again because there was so much confusion about what was happening. I think we have Martha Biebinger with us now. Are you there, Martha?
Hi, Tiziana.
Hi. So, Martha, as events began to unfold, you got called to service to report this story as well. How did you engage with the story as you found out the news about the bombings or whatever you thought the news was when you first heard about it?
I just focused on calling the hospitals and trying to figure out what the scene was like there. How many people they were treating, in what kinds of conditions, whether they could manage everyone. You know, there were just it was quite chaotic, of course. So it was hard to get a full picture. But you know, within 24 hours, it was pretty clear the extent and nature of the wounds and injuries and what had been done on an emergency basis to treat people.
And Martha, at that point, so, and let's start in that first 12 hours.
Mm-hmm.
At that stage in your reporting, so this is 10 years ago now, did you already have the kind of depth of relationships with hospitals, with physicians, with nurses, that you could call people and they were going to tell you what kind of experiences they were having? Like, could you hear it in their voices? Did you know them well enough to know that they were experiencing something unlike anything they had been through before?
I didn't talk to any of the people who were in the ORs. I only talked to people who were, you know, sort of treating people after the fact or who were in charge. For example, Dr. Paul Bittinger is the director of emergency preparedness for Mass General Brigham. At the time, it was for just Mass General. And, you know, emergency room doctors are very good at keeping that kind of level, monotone voice going in emergencies, but he couldn't do it. You know, it was a lot of this just like, almost like he was catching his breath every few words. It was really notable. And even from media teams who were outside the hospital, I think there was this quality in everyone's voice of just collective shock, of just trying to put words together that you didn't think made sense, you know, as you were speaking them. So, yeah, it was kind of wild.
I'm going to add a third voice. Retired WBUR Bruce Gellerman is on the line. Bruce, hello.
Hi, Tiziana.
So, Bruce, were you already on location at the marathon that day?
No. I was in the studio, and I think one of my editors, it was Mark Degon, came running down and saying to me what he knew. I have a kit bag with all my equipment in it, all ready to go for emergencies, and always have it ready. So I grabbed that, jumped on my bike, realizing that there was no other way I was going to get down there, and got down to, I think, Massachusetts Ave and Boylston, and smelled the explosive material. You could smell it, and people were rushing towards me. I put my bike a few blocks further to the finish line, and I didn't see it for another week because they wouldn't allow people on Boylston. But I was reporting on the scene within, I'd say, 16, 17 minutes and calling in. Thankfully, we had cell phones working. A lot of people didn't have their cell phones working. I don't know if it was overused or they blocked. I have no idea. And that's where I was. And that's where I basically spent the rest of most of that week, the next 4 or 5 days.
And Bruce, you focused heavily on first responders, law enforcement. It was interesting just now to hear Martha Biebinger say, you know, ER docs, man, they keep it cool because they're dealing with triage and emergency all the time. And even they were in a level of shock that it was hard to do that. Was there a level of disorientation from first responders? Were they surprised by what they encountered?
I actually was amazed at how organized they were. They were pushing everybody off of Boylston Street, going to the near the Westin Hotel over near the mall. And people were obeying, and it was orderly. It was quite amazing, actually, to in my mind. And so, no, I didn't feel that sense of disorientation. People people did what they were supposed to do, and people, cops did what they were supposed to do, and people did what they were supposed to do.
We're reflecting here on Radio Boston today. Tomorrow is 10 years since the explosion of two bombs at the finish line of the Boston Marathon, and we've made a conscious choice here on Radio Boston today to reflect, to mark the moment, but also to try to stay in a space of service and of hope. And in that space of service, we've asked three of the reporters here at WBUR who covered those days to join us. Steve Brown is here in Studio 2. Martha Biebinger is on the line, and retired WBUR reporter Bruce Gellerman also on the line. I'll turn back to you, Steve Brown. Everybody kind of became a utility player in those days and covered what they could, did what they had to. If they had a beat that was relevant, went there. But just like Bruce said, Mark Deegan came down, Bruce jumped on a bicycle and sort of were down there. What did you do next? You were doing newscast.
I was doing the midday, so my shift was supposed to be on till 4 o'clock. And Deb Becker was coming in to host All Things Considered that particular day.
We had some sound there of her talking with David Abel at the top of the...
That's right. And so I just knew that, you know, I wasn't going to get off at 4 o'clock. So I said to Deb, hey, why don't you just go in and finish the rest of my continuity breaks for the show? I'm going to just start walking down that way. And the WBUR studios are a mile from Kenmore Square, maybe 2 miles from the finish line. So I just started walking down that way and got in with all the runners who were still coming into Kenmore Square. And we didn't know, we knew there were explosions, but we didn't know the nature of everything. And these runners particularly, they're not listening to the radio. They're not on cell phones or things like that. So they were quite confused. They have no idea. And so they started pushing the runners, kind of walking down Comm Ave to the underpass of Mass Ave. And they were held up there. Everybody was held up there. And I was penned in with the runners. And finally, the BAA said, okay, continue down Commonwealth Avenue, and I forget how far down they wanted them to go, but they wanted to stay on the Comm Ave side, moving down towards the Public Garden. And somewhere down there, they were going to get their belongings, and the end of the race would be there. And so it was talking to runners who were quite confused as to what was going on. They were angry. They had just run a marathon, and they were told, stop, you can't go to the finish line. They were ticked off. One woman I remember being outraged. She says, I've never had a DNF. It did not finish. And she was angry about it. And I kind of knew what was going on to a certain extent. And it was like, you know, in the big scheme of things, having a DNF in a marathon, I'm sure you trained for it and everything. But what's going on a couple of blocks away from here far surpasses your completion of the race.
But she didn't know.
She didn't know.
And do you tell people in that moment? Do you tell them what's going on further down? Do you wait because you're not sure? I mean, now you've walked a mile, so you've lost time, right, as events are unfolding. How do you think about that?
You try to tell them, hey, there's been explosions there, and fill them in as much as you can. But again, as a reporter, I wasn't getting all the updates, the official updates that they might have been getting here at the newsroom and things like that. So you only know a certain amount. And we knew that there were explosions and that people were not going to be crossing the finish line.
Bruce, Martha, what about that? You know, these are events that are unfolding. And I think the two things I'm curious about from all three of you is at what point did you realize that the world had changed? That this was a story you were in the middle of, and the world was changing around you. Martha.
It evolved through that afternoon into the evening when, as I recall, Bruce and Steve, like, pretty much nobody went home. Or maybe they did eventually after midnight or one or something, but it was like time stopped in a weird way, and you know, you were... there was so much information and so many different details that were coming in all at once. I don't know, Tiziana, have you been in that situation where you just can't even process everything? And so you feel like you're behind and,
yes.
And that's also this feeling of time having stopped.
Yes. Like everything's happening almost in slow motion around you.
Yeah.
Bruce. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I kind of agree with that. I was with a group of reporters at the Westin. They had put together a media center there, and with the FBI and the DEA and every other piece of alphabet soup, you know, of law enforcement was there, and the reporters were there. So we're all jumbled together and mixed in, and then we were put into a big conference room, and everybody was in a state of, you know, shared suspended animation, I would say, and we just did our jobs, you know, we just fell back on what we do. And it was a very strange thing. And as Martha said, I know I didn't get home till way, way, way late that night, that next day. And then just kept on going for the next, you know, basically the next 5 or 6 days. It was quite intense. And boy, you're bringing me back there, Tiziana. I haven't been back to that since in a long time.
It can be hard to go back there, and I wonder in the reporting, I'm going to ask a question now that's going to feel gratuitous because we are WBUR. I don't mean it to feel gratuitous, and I'll note that at the time of the Boston Marathon, I was a listener. I wasn't at WBUR. And I asked this question as somebody who turned to the station then heavily. I'm talking to the three of you. Were there moments that other reporters had to cover that really stand out to you? So we've talked about moments the three of you covered. Were there moments that your colleagues covered in those first hours, that first 24 or so, that really stand out for any of the three of you?
Mm-hmm. I would say it was David Boeri's reporting. It was terrific. He had tremendous contacts within law enforcement at federal, state, and local levels. So he was all over the story. And he ran down to JFK and later in the week ran down to the federal building when it was supposed to be evacuated. It was evacuated. Bomb scare. There was a bomb scare at JFK. But Boeri's reporting was standout. He was terrific.
And he, of course, has retired from WBUR since then, too.
Bruce's coverage towards the end of the week in Watertown was amazing. And also, I want to call out, you know, at that time, not everybody at WBUR is a journalist. We got other, you know, people in other departments, and people were stepping up. I remember John Peck, who worked here at the time, wasn't in the newsroom or anything. He lived in Watertown, a block away from where that happened. And I woke up Friday morning, I'm hearing John Peck giving this extensive report on the air, describing what had just gone down in his neighborhood. That was absolutely amazing. And it's just how all of us, you know, not everybody at WBUR is on the air, is out covering things, has contacts. But when the time comes, everybody becomes a journalist here.
Martha.
Yeah, John Peck was amazing. He was in his basement hiding, you know. It was amazing reporting.
I remember that. I actually remember that Friday morning listening to that.
Yeah.
So, Martha, in the healthcare world, I mean, there was such deep strain on our hospitals, on our first responders, our first healthcare responders. Is there a story from those days, those first few days, that really stands out to you?
Yes. Well, I guess there's that picture of all of the docs and nurses and other emergency room staff at Mass General standing facing the door. Do you remember this picture, Tiziana?
They were
like 30 people standing there looking towards a camera, which you knew was at the entrance to the emergency room, like seconds before they were about to get slammed in one of the biggest mass casualty events that hospital had ever had to manage. And the looks on those faces, I definitely will remember those for a long time.
Thank you for reminding us of that, Martha. So let's look to today. Is there any legacy? And Bruce, you retired, but you reported for years at WBUR after that. Legacy of your reporting, Steve, Martha, Bruce, that lasted, that you covered something differently, that the echoes of what you learned as a reporter during the Boston Marathon bombings have affected how you've reported since then. Bruce.
Oh, I would say profoundly. As you know, I mean, when we got on the scene, you go back to basics, right? You ask the questions, who, what, where, when, how, why. But I've never stopped asking those questions. I kept on digging. And for the last 10 years, I've been digging. And the more I've dug into the record and who was where and what was what, when was when, and who did what, the more questions I actually have, Tiziana. I got to tell you that even now, 10 years later, we still don't know who built the bombs. I mean, that's extraordinarily important. And the federal prosecutor, William Weinreb, has told us that. And I keep on digging into that. He told us the brothers didn't have the skills and the materials to build the bombs. It's in the testimony. It's
so open questions for you.
Yeah. How about the same questions?
How about you, Martha?
I think I learned a lot that I carry with me today about how to report on trauma, how to approach people, kind of space or distance is appropriate, the ways to phrase questions, how often you can go back to people, the kind of morality of asking people to reopen old wounds. Those are things that unfolded for several years after the bombing, you know, as we continue to talk to some of the survivors and as they continue to deal with things like the trials. And so, yeah, those have been incredibly helpful to me in all kinds of healthcare reporting.
And Steve, I'm going to close a little differently with you because there's a memory you have of the day after. After the initial shock of the attack wore off, you went down into the city. You were walking the streets of Boston. You encountered a saxophonist. I'm going to play a little sound.
My name is Kevin Bussey. I'm from Chicago, Illinois. I figured I'd come out here to play saxophone so I could spread the message of peace. I think that there are more good people in this world than bad people, and we can overcome from things like this and move on with our everyday lives.
I heard that saxophone on Newbury Street, and it just captured the melancholy feeling that just enveloped this city. And I had to record it, and I had to ask him why, and I got a lot of response from former employees who said, you know, I've been holding it together, but now I've just heard it, and wow, and that kind of captured the feeling of the city.
Steve Brown, Martha Biebinger, Bruce Gellerman, all reporters at WBUR on the day of the Boston Marathon bombings. Thank you to the three of you.
Thanks for having
us. You're welcome.
Thank you.
There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering. You're listening to Radio Boston. Today, we are reflecting back on the Boston Marathon bombings. Tomorrow, Saturday, will mark 10 years since they happened. And if it's not too hard for you to join us, we'd like to continue our reflection together. We've heard now our WBUR reporters and how they remember the events. But what about the rest of us? How do we as a community remember and mark them today? With us to explore that is Marta Crilly, archivist for reference and outreach at the Boston City Archives, and Megan Zippin, survivor of the 2013 Boston Marathon bombings and author of the new book, First Light, which comes out tomorrow on Saturday. Megan, welcome.
Thank you so much.
And congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
And Marta, welcome back to you.
Thank you for having me.
So, Meg, I'm going to start with two simple questions for
sure.
You. One word to describe how you felt then, back in 2013, after it happened.
Stunned.
And one word to describe how you feel about it today, 10 years later.
Hopeful.
So, Marta, it's that gap. That's what we want to talk about, that change in perspective over time. It happens all the time, right? It is human nature to change over time.
Yes, absolutely.
And so that is, in fact, as I understand it, part of the point of archives, right? Is to bring to anchor a point in time, both so that we can remember it, but also to allow us to change.
Yes, that's right. Our perspective does change with time. And so it's important for us to save records from particular moments so we're able to remember accurately the cultural moment. This is what happened. This is how it felt.
I was thinking about that. I was thinking about that because it is important to remember accurately. And yet, and Meg, I'll turn back to you. The fact that we don't remember accurately forever is also a really important part of healing.
I think so.
I don't want to relive my greatest traumas as if I were there in the moment 10 years later. And yet your poetry is in part a processing, right?
Yes.
10 years later. Talk a little bit about that.
So with an event like the Boston Marathon bombing, for those of us who were there, and I think also for people who weren't, that type of abnormal event leaves a timestamp in your body. Like, your body remembers what happened. And so it is a process of kind of getting through the immediacy, having space from it, and being able to make choices with a new lens, perhaps, on the world. And so my poetry and the collection tells the story of how I felt then. It tells the story of my victim impact statement, being in the room with the bomber at the trial. And then my hope is that it begins to tell a story of healing, of how to accompany someone through trauma if you're witnessing it, and the journey of my relationship with my husband, and ultimately being the mom to three boys who have only known parents that are post-marathon.
Okay, so stay with me. I wanted to put that in place, and Marta, I'll come back to you in a minute. Now, Meg, tell us your story of that day.
Sure. So I was a runner that day, and everybody knows the right on Hereford, left on Boylston. I took that right, and as I took the left, I had a couple friends waiting for me. They blew me kisses. I blew them kisses back, and they said, "We're running to the finish." And I said, "Okay." So I ran on the Boylston. They ran on the sidewalk. The first explosion happened. I thought it was fireworks. I thought it was a car backfiring. Your brain tries to make sense of it. And it caused me to turn around. I hit the finish line, and about 30 feet away, the second explosion happened. And then it was just neon smoke and screaming. And fortunately, I wasn't hit by shrapnel. But I knew that both of the girls were in that mess. And immediately began my hunt to try and find them.
Did you?
I didn't then. No.
But later?
Later I did. Later I did. They were fortunate to be taken to some of the best medical centers in the world, I think, and did have life-threatening injuries, but both of their lives were saved, and they're living, although different, very beautiful lives now.
Again, I want to note we're remembering 10 years of the Boston Marathon bombings today. We are focused on service and hope here at Radio Boston, and we're speaking with Megan Zippin, who is her survivor, Marta Crilly, who is the archivist at the Boston City Archives. It is a difficult conversation. We will stay in spaces of survival and hope and service. I just want to make listeners aware. So, Marta, I will turn to you now. The archives... It's a silly question, but I don't know any other way to ask it. At what moment do the archives begin to collect? Is it from 2 days before the marathon? Is it from the moment of the bombings? I know these are the curatorial choices you have to make.
Yeah. So what happened was almost immediately after the bombing, Boylston Street was blocked off because it was a crime scene. And very quickly after that happened, people started to leave things at the blockades, flowers, sneakers, messages. And on April 23rd, Boylston Street was opened back up. And the city workers who removed those barricades were left with these items and weren't sure what to do with them. And so they moved them to nearby Copley Square, feeling that these needed to stay up in the public view. But some of the items were fragile enough or really couldn't be moved. And so they took those to City Hall.
Like what? What's an example of something that would be so fragile that it couldn't be moved?
Small pieces of paper, for example. So maybe paper the size of like an index card. Things of that nature, just like very kind of small pieces of paper.
Like somebody might have scrawled a note.
Exactly. And a lot of these pieces, when you look at them, you can see they were very much left in the moment. It's a little piece of notebook paper that somebody was walking by and felt moved to put down a message. And a lot of the things that were left at Boylston Street, you can see kind of the immediacy of them, that they were done in the moment.
I remember a photograph of one that says, "You've only made us stronger."
Yes. Yes. And I believe that is written, you can tell it's written on a piece of notebook paper that someone has torn off. So not, doesn't seem to be something they thought about in advance. So the following day, someone from the mayor's office called us and said, "I have all of these items in my office and we're not sure what to do with them. Can the city archives help?" And that was the start of the process of us taking in items from the memorial and helping to plan what would happen to the memorial when it was eventually taken down.
This is the temporary memorial, all those things that were moved.
Yes, that's right. The temporary memorial in Copley Square. It stayed up until June 25th. So it was in Copley Square from April 24th to June 25th, 2 months.
What is among the most unusual items in the collection? And I don't mean from a Ripley believe it or not. I mean the ways that either an event shows up in things, or that people add themselves to a moment with a thing.
One of the things that I think is most striking and unusual about the messages that are left are the number of languages that show up. Some languages that I actually can't identify, that we haven't been able to identify. And I think that speaks to it speaks to a couple of things: the international character of the marathon, the international character of the city of Boston. There are a lot of people here speaking different languages. And then the outpouring of solidarity and support that we saw from around the world.
So I'll turn back to you now, Meg. And I'm actually going to play you some sound. So we reached out to our listeners and asked them for their responses, you know, sort of what gives you hope, what gives you strength. And there's actually two things. First, I'm going to read you one. And if you, this came from a text, if you want to join our texting group, you can send the word Boston, particularly appropriate today. You can send the word Boston to 617-766-0382. That's 617-766-0382. John of Upton said, "I'm not so much focused on hope as I am on inspiration and pride that the Boston Marathon continues to engender optimism and validation that the events of a decade ago cannot dampen this optimism." And then we had somebody call in to our voicemail. Lynn of Boston sent this message.
"The anniversary has been much, much harder for me than I ever expected. Somehow 10 years seems like such a long time, and yet it can still feel like it was just last year. I'm hoping the 10-year anniversary brings some kind of closure for survivors and victims' families, that this year allows us to move forward with our lives, accept our new bodies, and for people like me with brain injury, our new minds, and allow us to learn to love our new selves and move forward and support each other."
How did you begin to move forward, and who helped support you over these last 10 years?
That's a really great question. I do think it's different for everyone, just to kind of encompass both of those folks who left messages. It took me a while. I would say that whole first year after was kind of a blur. And eventually starting to get into therapy and even say the word PTSD out loud. I don't even think I said it until maybe just before the trial, that this actually could be something that I'm experiencing. And I think those around me, you know, people are only privy to what you show them or what you tell them. So if you look very much either together or okay, there isn't necessarily a need to champion. So what's so important is to say, like, it's okay that you're not okay. And my husband became my champion and you know, now knows to raise the flag when I'm not doing so hot. So the therapeutic relationships that I've had, yoga and the teachers I've had, writing, and ultimately my children, they demand presence. And when you are 5 and 3 and 1, you need mama to be there. And they will forever be my greatest gift for that reason.
I want to mark a couple of things here. You talked about PTSD, that's post-traumatic stress disorder. And I do want to note, we are talking about trauma and its mental health impacts. And if you or someone that you love is experiencing a mental health crisis, there is a hotline that you can reach out to 24 hours a day by phone or text. It's the Mental Health and Suicide Crisis Hotline, and the number is 988. Again, by phone or text, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 988. And Marta, I'll turn back to you. Meg just said, people only see what you show them or tell them. I'm struck, and it just struck me when Meg said that part of what you have curated in this archive is what people have been secretly and anonymously expressing in those days after the bombing, right? I saw the pictures of many of those pieces of paper that you sent some over. They're not signed. They're not named. The flowers don't have "from so-and-so" on them. The sneakers don't have your address on the bottom. This was a communal but also anonymous, I mean, decidedly anonymous demonstration of strength and solidarity, but also grief.
Yes, that's right. And I think if we look at the memorial, it's a complicated place, and a lot of different things were happening. And so one thing that's happening is memory and people remembering. But I think another thing that was happening at the memorial was community grief and solidarity. And we had a researcher from the Australian Red Cross come out to do research in the collection. And her research focused on how these types of temporary memorials help people to heal, because the show of solidarity helps people to not feel isolated and helps them to feel supported. You know, if we have over a million messages of support and solidarity, that for some people, and it's different for everyone, but for some people, that can be a huge part of the healing process.
And on that, Meg, will you read for us from your new book?
For sure. Thank you. So this is from one of the poems called Love Letters. Trying must matter. It must. It must. If you only knew how well you were doing. In regards to who? Old me? Wait. Be patient. You're not alone. But I am. When the panic strikes, I am. I beg to not be alone. Survivors write love letters. We grow bigger hearts. We feel deeper gratitude. Our patience is masked by overwhelming fatigue. But it's in there, I promise, right next to our try. Trying must matter, because otherwise we're just existing. And just existing will never, ever be enough.
Let's just stop there. Megan Zippin is a survivor of the 2013 Boston Marathon bombings, author of the new book, First Light. We just heard a portion of a poem that is out on Saturday. And Marta Crilly is archivist for reference and outreach at the Boston City Archives. Both joined us today in our reflection on 10 years after two bombs exploded at the finish line of the Boston Marathon. Megan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Marta, thanks for coming back to Radio Boston.
It's always good to be here.
Tomorrow is 10 years since the Boston Marathon bombings, and we have been remembering that today with a focus on service and hope. Thank you for reflecting with us. Part of hope is running again, and people have kept running. The bombings didn't stop that. Only a global pandemic could, and only for a while. Through it all, Alex Ashlock has covered it with and for us. And he'll be there again Monday when runners test themselves and run for others. Alex has covered the marathon for WBUR since 1998. He is on the line. Alex Ashlock, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. Hey, Alex, do you want to reflect for a moment on 10 years yourself? It's got to have been weighing on your mind.
Yeah, you know, it's every anniversary of the bombings sort of feels like it was yesterday to me, but especially This one, after listening to your previous guest talk about surviving the bombing and then the aftermath of the bombing, I'm in Copley Square, right now, not that far from the finish line. I came down here every day afterward. I remember the memorials. I remember the day they took the memorial down here in Copley Square. So it's very much in my mind, and it's very much in the mind, I think, of everybody who's getting ready to run the marathon on Monday, that it's been 10 years since that terrible afternoon.
So let's stay there, because I know with that in mind, security for this year's marathon is important. Alex, what are officials saying about the measures that are being taken?
Well, there was a public safety briefing yesterday. Federal, state, and local agencies are in charge of security here. It's a multi-agency, you know, complex plan every year to try to secure a 26.2-mile marathon course. Joe Bonavolonta spoke. He was one of the speakers. He's special agent in charge of the FBI field office here in Boston. He says there's no credible threat targeting this year's race, but he still is urging people to be vigilant. He said tips from the community can really make a difference. And the big message, Tiziana, is if you see someone or something suspicious, say something. Here's Joe.
There's almost always somebody after the fact who says they saw the person change, whether it be a parent, a classmate, or a friend. When people speak up, history has shown that we can prevent these tragedies from occurring.
And security has been very much enhanced since the bombings in 2013. If you're a spectator on Monday, you'll see the security presence with uniformed police officers. The National Guard will be here, but there will also be undercover officers in the crowd. There'll be security checkpoints along the way, especially as you get closer to the finish line here in downtown Boston. If you're a spectator, the best advice is to travel very light on Monday. No backpacks, no coolers. Again, it'll be a lot like it's been since those bombings in 2013. Very heavy security.
So the race is Monday. Tomorrow, Saturday, though, is the 10th anniversary. There will be a number of events. How will the city mark the anniversary, Alex?
Well, there are two remembrances. One is early in the morning. This is a private ceremony. It'll be a wreath laying at the two bombing sites, which are now memorial sites here on Boylston Street. This is for the families of the victims and people who survived the bombings that day in 2013. Mayor Michelle Wu has emphasized that everything the city is doing to mark this 10th anniversary is with those groups in mind, those communities. Here she is speaking yesterday about what tomorrow should mean.
To reflect on what we all experienced and what some families have forever been changed by, the loss that they continue to bear, and also what is ahead for us, what these 10 years have meant in the growth of our community and our commitment to each other in charting a course for our future that includes everyone.
Tomorrow afternoon at 2:30, the mayor will also participate in a more public event here on Boylston Street in downtown Boston. There'll be a dedication of a new commemorative finish line. Church bells will ring, probably from the Old South Church, which is not far from where I'm speaking to you from today. There'll be a new One Boston Day marker unveiled on Boylston Street. One Boston Day is the day that's been established on April 15th every year since the bombings to mark public service. It's a day of public service. There'll be food drives, blood drives, neighborhood cleanups. Lots of opportunities, Tiziana, just for people to just reach out to their neighbors, maybe be generous to someone, call somebody you haven't spoken to for a while. That's really supposed to be the spirit of the day. You mentioned earlier people running on Monday. I should also mention that early tomorrow morning, about 10,000 runners will participate in the annual Boston Athletic Association 5K road race, which will cross the finish line here on Boylston Street. So that'll probably be a pretty emotional experience as well for people in that event tomorrow morning.
All right, so now let's talk about the elite runners for Monday. They met this morning. That's where you are. What jumps out to
yes.
you?
Well, the thing that jumps out is Eliud Kipchoge. I think you asked me a few months ago, I think, when we were talking together about what I was looking forward to
yep.
for this year's marathon. I said, hey, we got to get Kipchoge here. He's the world record holder, two-time Olympic marathon champion. I don't think he's run a race in the United States for something like 9 years. He'd never run Boston before. and he's here to run the marathon on Monday. He's the man to beat in the men's race. He said he's here, he knows the history, he recognizes the history, and that's why he's here, to be part of that history, the 127th Boston Marathon.
I know that he is astonishingly fast. Everyone will be watching him. Are there other runners in the men's field that we shouldn't ignore, even if he may be way out in front of them?
You know, there's runners here that I've never even said anything about in my previewing the races that have ended up winning. But there's two guys that I would look at. Evans Chebet won the race last year. Benson Kipruto won the race, I think it was the year before. Those two guys train together. They're both from Kenya as well. I can see them working together on Monday to kind of maybe test Kipchoge. I mean, he never fails a test, but I think they might work together on Monday to see what he has and if he can really win the Boston Marathon on a course unlike any course he's ever run a marathon on before.
I guess I should ask you, do you think there's any chance he breaks the world record on this course?
He's not going to break the world record on this course, I don't think. You can't bet on the marathon. I probably wouldn't bet that he won't break the world record here, but he set the world record in Berlin. It's a very fast course. He had pacemakers helping him set that record. I think he could set the course record here, which is 2 hours, 3 minutes, and 2 seconds, but setting the world record here would be just unbelievable. He is unbelievable. He's Michael Jordan. I don't count anything out, but a world record here would be really amazing.
All right, now tell us about the strength of the women's field.
There's really a great field here in the women's race. Something like 9 of them have run faster than the course record here, which is 2 hours, 19 minutes, and 59 seconds. Two-time Boston victor Edna Kiplagat is here again. There's also Amane Bariso of Ethiopia. She's run a marathon under 2 hours and 15 minutes.
Wow.
So I think she might be testing the women's field on Monday. But there's just a bunch of great women in the race as well. Nell Rojas is top American the last 2 Boston marathons. Des Linden is here again. She won so famously in 2018. So the women's race will be great as well.
We've got about 60 seconds left, and I understand that there has been a bit of a monopoly on the wheelchair races. Tell us about those athletes.
Yeah, Manuela Schaar and Tatiana McFadden have really dominated the women's race in recent years. Tatiana McFadden isn't here, but Manuela Schaar of Switzerland is, so look for her on Monday. American Daniel Romanchuk and Marcel Hug of Switzerland will be the top contenders in the men's race. They've shared the last 7 Boston Marathon titles, so you can look for them on Monday as well.
All right, and we will have your reporting with us here on Radio Boston on Monday. Is that right, Alex?
That's correct.
It's going to be a marathon day for you, I think.
I love it.
Excellent.
You know I love it.
I know you do, and I love hearing from you every year. Alex Ashlock, WBUR's marathon reporter. Always great to have you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Amanda Beland, Kyrie Thompson, and Rob Lane, with Bart Tachi and John Bender. Irina Machavariani is our newsroom fellow. Marquise Neal is our senior technical director. Titus Faladun is our executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thank you for reflecting with us today. Join us again on Marathon Monday for more Radio Boston.